Let's see. Let's start. First of all, any questions that any of you have left over from yesterday's discussions, what we talked about? Okay, if not, we'll launch right into today's topics, which the handout that I gave you yesterday, the handout on the backgrounds of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll break that out. What I want to do, I won't normally go through any handouts word for word, but there is so much information packed into this handout that I do want to go through and read it and bring up a couple of other points and answer any questions you might have out of that handout. Part of what I'll be going through in these first few lectures here overlaps into the category of apologetics, because there are a lot of criticisms about the Bible in general and about the Gospels in particular, where scholars have found they can make a lot of money by writing books that criticize the Bible and criticize the Gospels in particular. So I want to address in these early classes some of the common objections that are brought up about the Gospels from authors who will say a common view is that the Gospels were not written by first century eyewitnesses, that they were written 1 century or 2 century or 3 centuries later by people in places like Rome or elsewhere in Italy or North Africa. And they weren't really eyewitnesses to these events. They were making it all up. Those are common views that you'll see in a number of scholarly books and arguments. So we'll, in the next class or two, we'll address some of those points and discuss some of these things from an apologetic standpoint, how you can defend your faith and belief in the gospel. So let's start off now. By the way, this we'll get into later on today, but first I want to go through this handout. So we'll start with Matthew. Matthew means gift of God in Hebrew. Matthew is not, it's a derivation of his Hebrew name, which was Matityahu. Matityahu. You don't have to write that down, but all of the apostles, well, most of the apostles do have Hebrew Jewish names. His was Matityahu. It's Matthew when transliterated into Greek and then into English. Matthew was a tax collector who left his work as a tax collector to follow Jesus, as recorded in Matthew 9:9-13. And Mark and Luke, he is called by his other name, Levi, as we would commonly pronounce it, Levi in Hebrew, Levi. Another word for tax collector is publican. You see that term often in the Gospels, not a word that is used today, but that's what it meant at that time. Matthew resided at Capernaum on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. This was a lucrative spot for a tax collector because there was a considerable amount of fishing in the Sea of Galilee. There was also the major road, the Via Maris, or the Way of the Sea. And let's see, if you'll look on page 139 of your Harmony of the Gospels, the close-up view of the Sea of Galilee, you'll see this dotted line coming in from the left side. The dotted lines on here are indicating the ancient roads. And you'll see this one that comes in between Cana and Sepphoris and over along the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee and going up. That is what is called the Via Maris. I'll address this later on. But this does play, it's never explicitly spelled out. But we'll see that it does play a major role in Christ's ministry. That was kind of the interstate highway system of the day. It's an ancient road going back many, many centuries before the first century. Going back, it was the major trade route and invasion route between the empires of Babylon and Egypt and so on. So it's a very, very well-known route. And Jesus actually uses that to his advantage, as we'll cover a little bit later on. Continuing here with a handout, Via Maris is Latin for via is way, Maris, sea, as in maritime, mariner. Maris in Latin means sea, the way of the sea or the road of the sea, the route of the sea. The way of the sea went all the way over to Babylon. It came down through Damascus and Israel and went all the way down to Egypt. This is one of the roads primarily used when Israel was invaded. In ancient times, you'll read about the different invaders who come through in your Old Testament classes. And this is the route that they used, Egypt coming up from the south, Babylon and Assyria, others coming down from the north. It was a road of commerce. We could compare the Via Maris to something like an interstate highway system of that day. Matthew was the man who was named by the Romans to be the tax collector in this particular city. I'd like to comment on that briefly. Tax collecting was different in that age than it is done today. Today you get the IRS form, you fill it out, you do it on your laptop, your computer, whatever, go to a tax preparer, and everything is pretty standard. In that day it worked a little bit different. Things were not standardized the way, as best we can tell historically, and this particular period in this particular part of the Roman Empire, there was a system called tax farming. And what that meant is the tax collectors would actually bid for the job of tax collector. So just to use some hypothetical numbers, let's say that Matthew bid $1 million for the local government to for the right and authority to collect taxes. And what that meant is if he bid $1 million, anything he collected above and beyond $1 million was his to keep. So if he collected $1.5 million in taxes, then his net was $500,000. It was a way to become quite wealthy in that time. And because there wasn't necessarily a set tax, you could bully, you could extort people. It was whatever the market would bear, as much money as you could get out of people, whatever you collected above and beyond what you had bid to the authorities was yours to keep. So there was an automatic incentive for tax collectors there to lie, to bully, to steal from the general population. This is why tax collectors are held in such low regard. They're classified along with prostitutes and things like that. They were viewed as very evil. We'll talk about that a little more when we get into the calling of Matthew. But this is a system that is going on in that day, just a nutshell. And this was a very lucrative spot because Matthew, as tax collector, could collect taxes on all of the fishermen. There were about a dozen ports around the Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee, incidentally, is quite small. We would never call it a sea today. It's smaller than a number of our reservoirs here in the United States. It's roughly, off the top of my head, I think about 8 miles wide east and west and about 10 to 12 miles north and south. So it's about the size of one of our big reservoirs. But there were a lot of fishermen fishing on the lake, a lot of small ports, and Capernaum is one of the ports there. And it's also where the Via Maris goes through. So Matthew could collect taxes from all the fishermen there, as well as the trade going back and forth, the commerce going back and forth along the Via Maris. So he is quite a wealthy individual, as we'll see later on as well. Okay, continuing on, place of writing. The Jewish nature of Matthew's gospel suggests that it may have been written in the Holy Land, and I certainly believe that is the case. Recipients, who is it written to? Many elements point to Matthew's gospel being written to a Jewish audience, Jewish / Hebrew. I'll use those terms fairly interchangeably. The population there is predominantly Jewish, but there are some elements of some of the other scattered 12 tribes mixed in. Paul, for instance, is a Benjamite there. So there's others from the tribe of Levi, a few other scattered refugees dating back to the time of Hezekiah and the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions and so on. First bullet point under recipients, a reason why we know this is oriented toward a Jewish audience. First is Matthew's concern with the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. He has more quotations from and allusions or references to the Old Testament than any other New Testament author. And of course, at that time, the Jews did expect a Messiah to arise. So Matthew repeatedly details how Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecies of the coming Messiah, and that would be particularly relevant to a Jewish audience. Second bullet point, his tracing of Jesus' descent from Abraham and his genealogy. We'll talk about that a little bit later when we get there. So he is very careful to show that Jesus is a descendant of Abraham. And of course, Abraham is the father of the Jewish people, as he was considered, kind of like our George Washington, the father of our country, you might say. Also, third bullet point, Matthew doesn't explain Jewish customs. He just mentions them, but he doesn't explain them. He doesn't explain them because he's writing to a Jewish audience. There's no need to explain them. For instance, if we were writing to somebody about Thanksgiving, we wouldn't explain what Thanksgiving is because we all know. But if you were writing to somebody in another country where they don't keep Thanksgiving, you would need to spell that out. Just a similar type example there. Mark, in contrast, and John and Luke to a lesser degree, because they are writing to other audiences, do take time to sometimes spell out what the Jewish customs are. Also, fourth bullet point, Matthew uses Jewish terminology such as kingdom of heaven, where Luke and Mark refer to the kingdom of God. Matthew uses kingdom of heaven. Why would he do that, writing to a Jewish audience? Well, because of the third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. So rather than saying God, kingdom of God, Matthew uses kingdom of heaven. Heaven being a synonym for God. And Jesus apparently does this regularly himself as well. Also, next bullet point, his emphasis on Jesus' role as the son of David. Number of scripture references there. Which again emphasizes David was Israel's greatest poet, their greatest general. Again, kind of a George Washington type figure, very pronounced role in Israelite history, greatly respected. And of course, the Messiah was to be a descendant of David. Last bullet point here in this section: this does not mean that Matthew restricts his gospel to the Jews. In other words, it's not only Jewish-oriented. For example, he records the coming of the Magi, who are non-Jewish, to worship the infant Jesus in Matthew 2. He states that the field is the world, and to pray for God to send more harvest, more laborers for the harvest, to get the word out to the whole world, to Gentiles as well. He also gives a full statement of the Great Commission, which is to go into all the world, preach the gospel to every creature. So these passages show that although Matthew's gospel is Jewish in its orientation, it does have a universal outlook as well, reflecting Jesus' desire for all mankind to ultimately receive God's gift of salvation. Purpose. Matthew's main purpose is to prove to Jewish readers that Jesus is their Messiah. He does this primarily by showing how Jesus in his life and ministry fulfill the Old Testament scriptures. Matthew also emphasizes Jesus being a descendant of King David as the Messiah was to be, and also, as mentioned earlier, descendant of Abraham and the fulfillment of many others who he was to be a descendant from. Structure. This is quite important. Maybe if you go through your Harmony of the Gospel, you'll realize that the authors put things in different order. Why do they do that? I touched on that briefly a little bit yesterday, that Mark apparently follows the most strict chronological order, so that is the way the Harmony is organized, in the order of events that Mark records them. Matthew's Gospel is woven around five great discourses or collections of sayings. First of these is a Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7. Then it gives the commission to the 12 disciples in chapter 10. Then the parables of the kingdom in chapter 13. Then the necessity for humility and forgiveness in Matthew 18. And then the Olivet prophecy in Matthew 24 and 25. That this is deliberate, this is a deliberate way Matthew organizes his gospel, is clear from the words that conclude each of these five collections of sayings, where Matthew says something like, when Jesus had finished these sayings, or some variation closely related to that, and you'll see the references to that there. So what Matthew has done, to summarize this, is he's taken five collections of Jesus' sayings, and that's the way he organized his gospel. Very different from the way we would write about somebody today. We, in our Western thinking, always think very linearly, very chronologically. The way a Jewish mind of that period would write would be very different. They would organize things along themes here, which is what Matthew has done, being Jewish. And then in between these five collections of sayings are narrative information that transitions from one set to the next. So this is why you'll see those big differences between the way Matthew organizes his gospel, the events in there, versus how Mark does. You could also, next page, you could also argue there are two other discourses. For instance, Matthew 23, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, where he really lambasts the scribes and the Pharisees for their religious hypocrisy. And the other, at the very end of the book, Matthew 28, 16 through 20, where he gives the Great Commission. Go you therefore into all the world, preach the gospel to every creature, make disciples, teaching them everything that I have told you or commanded you. Any questions about Matthew? Again, we'll touch on these themes a little bit more as we come across examples of it, but I want to give you this background up front here, so you'll kind of, it's very helpful to understand where the authors are coming from, what their purpose is, what their audience is, because that explains some of the differences we'll run into in the gospel. Some authors will include stories, anecdotes that the others do not. And this is why. It's because of their purpose and who they're writing to. This explains why there are some of those differences in there. Okay, moving on to Mark, the Gospel of Mark. The author appears to be Mark or John Mark, as he is called in Acts 12, verses 12 and 25. Mark is probably the person unnamed who is referred to in Mark 14, 51 and 52, where the authorities come to arrest Jesus at Gethsemane, and there's a young man who runs away naked when one of the soldiers grabs his cloak, and the man runs off into the darkness without his cloak on. His cloak was kind of a nightshirt, as we would call it today. You had an outer cloak and an inner cloak. One was your undergarment. That's what this is referring to. And he's not wearing anything under there, so he runs off naked into the night. That is probably Mark himself inserting this little anecdote about himself into the story. Mark was a close associate of Peter, from whom he received the information that he gives in his gospel. It seems that this information did not come to Mark as a finished account of the life of Jesus, but the preaching or the teaching or the stories of Peter arranged and shaped by Mark. In other words, Peter did not sit down and dictate this to Mark, but Mark, as a companion of Peter, heard Peter telling these stories and put these stories together into this gospel. For this reason, some refer to this as Peter's gospel or Peter's story. The first mention of Mark is in connection with his mother Mary, who had a house in Jerusalem that served as a meeting place for believers in Acts 12. When Paul and Barnabas returned to Antioch from Jerusalem after the famine visit, Mark accompanied them again in Acts 12. Mark next appears as a helper to Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey, recorded in Acts 13. But he deserted them at Perga to return to Jerusalem. Paul was deeply disappointed with Mark's actions because when Barnabas proposed taking Mark on a second journey, Paul refused, a refusal that broke up the working relationship between Paul and Barnabas, so they go their separate ways. Paul is very disappointed in Mark because he had turned away and left them, but Barnabas goes on and takes Mark with him. Mark was his cousin, Colossians 4 and verse 10, Barnabas' his cousin, and he departed for Cyprus. No further mention is made of either of them in the book of Acts. However, Mark reappears in Paul's letter to the Colossians written from Rome. Paul sends a greeting from Mark and adds, "You have received instructions about him. If he comes to you, welcome him." So Mark and Paul have made up, and Paul has accepted Mark as a helper to him in his ministry. In Philemon, verse 24, Paul calls Mark one of his fellow laborers. Sorry for the typo there. I'll correct that. One of his laborers. Mark had worked his way back into Paul's confidence. By the end of Paul's life, Mark has fully regained Paul's favor. See 2 Timothy 4 and verse 11. Place of writing, Mark was probably written from Rome. Recipients, the evidence points to the church at Rome, or at least to Gentile readers. So we've got Matthew, who's writing to a Jewish audience. We've got Mark, who's writing to pretty much the opposite audience. He's writing to church members, but church members who are in Rome, in the heart of the belly of the beast there. Mark explains Jewish customs. He translates Aramaic words from Aramaic into Greek and seems to have a special interest in persecution and martyrdom, subjects of special concern to Roman believers. Here's the kicker. He also includes several Latin phrases that would have meant nothing to Jewish readers, and this is an indication that he's writing specifically to people in Rome, where Latin was the common language. Greek was the overall common language of the empire of the day. I just traveled to Greece for the feast this year, and it's interesting. I've been to the Middle East a number of times, various countries in Europe, and English is pretty much the universal language around the world today. Doesn't mean everybody speaks it, but wherever you go, you can find people with a good working knowledge of English. And that was the case with Greek in the Roman world of the first century. Even though the Greek Empire had been conquered by Rome, Greek was the language that was commonly spoken around the Roman Empire. Latin would have been spoken more just in Rome itself or among Roman governing officials and so on. But Greek was the common everyday language, except in the Holy Land or in Israel, where Aramaic or Hebrew were used. People would know some Greek, but not necessarily as certainly not as their native tongue there. Emphases in the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark. First of a bullet point, Jesus is the Son of God. Mark emphasizes the humanity of Jesus, but also emphasizes that he is the Son of God. One of the ways he does this is by emphasizing miracles. Mark includes 18 miracles of Jesus in his gospel. Second bullet point, he emphasizes the death of Jesus. He emphasizes that the Jewish leadership conspired to kill Jesus, but that also this was a divine necessity that Jesus die for the sins of mankind. Also, he emphasizes the teachings of Jesus. And although Mark records far fewer actual teachings of Jesus than John and Matthew and Luke, there is a strong emphasis on Jesus being the teacher. The words teacher, teach, or teaching, and rabbi are applied to Jesus 39 times in Mark. So Mark is the shortest gospel by about half. That's about half the length of Matthew, Luke, and John, but he emphasizes teacher and teaching repeatedly. Next page of the handout, discipleship. Mark talks a great deal about what it means to be a disciple and follower of Jesus Christ, and a number of references to that. Final point, Mark's gospel has an emphasis on action. It's a simple but vivid account of Jesus' ministry, emphasizing more what Jesus did than what he said. Why does Mark do this? Two reasons. First, Peter, who is the source of Mark's material, was a man of action. Peter's always the one out in front, sticking his foot in his mouth at various times. He's always the one who acts first and thinks later there. So Peter's a man of action, but also the Romans were a people of action. One thing that the Roman world would really appreciate was people who got things done. How many of you have been to Italy for the feast? Okay, quite a few of you, yeah. And it's just incredible to walk around Italy and see things like the Colosseum, the Roman Forum, the temples, the palaces, the buildings, the Pantheon there. If you've been there, here's a temple to the Roman gods that was built almost 2,000 years ago. And it still stands and is in great condition to this day. You can go various places around Europe and see Roman roads and aqueducts that still exist. They're still operational in some cases. Bridges that are 2,000 years old, and they still stand. So the Romans were people of great accomplishment. They were doers. They were builders. They built an empire. They built things you can still see today all over Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. And Mark seems to include that in his gospel because the Romans could identify with people of action, like Peter, like Jesus Christ. Jesus is a man of action as well. Okay, any questions about Mark here? Marcus. Incidentally, one thing, why is he called John Mark? You are probably familiar, may have heard this. A number of characters in the New Testament have two names. One is a Hebrew name, one is a Greek or Roman name. John Mark, John would have been Yochanan in Hebrew, and Mark or Marcus would have been the Latin name or Greek Marcus. So Yochanan is his Hebrew name, Mark or Marcus would be his Latin or Greek name. Paul is an example of that. Paul is his Latin or Greek name. What's his Hebrew name? Anyone? Yes. Shaul, Shaul. We read it as Saul in Hebrew, Shaul, Shaul. Very, very good. So we see that with a number of different people. Even Peter, what's his Hebrew name? Yeah. Kepha, well, that's kind of a nickname, but his Hebrew name is Shimon, Simon, Peter, Petros. Petros is Greek, Peter. Petros meaning a rock, a pebble there. So Shaul, Paul, Simon, Peter. So see this at a number of different times. So same thing with Mark here. Okay, continuing on with Luke. This gospel is a companion volume to the book of Acts, and the language and structure of these two books indicate that both were written by the same person. I assume you've already covered this. So the book of Acts and the gospel of Luke are addressed to the same individual, Theophilus. And the second volume refers to the first. You can read that in Acts 1. Acts 1 and verse 1, where Luke addresses this to most excellent Theophilus. Certain sections in Acts use the pronoun we, showing that the author was with Paul when the events in these passages took place. By process of elimination, Paul's dear friend Luke, the doctor, as he's called in Colossians 4:14, and fellow worker, as he's called in Philemon 24, becomes the most likely candidate. I will note that all four of the Gospels, none of them in the oldest documents we have, say, hey, I'm the Gospel of Matthew. I, Matthew, wrote this Gospel, or I, Mark, wrote this Gospel, or I, Luke, wrote this. That doesn't appear in the manuscripts, but there is very early tradition going back that associates these names with these Gospels, and I do, from my studies, believe that is correct. We have no reason to really doubt that these are the individuals who wrote these. Continuing here, Luke was probably a Gentile by birth. He was well-educated in Greek culture, a physician by profession, and an outstanding command of the Greek language. He's a native Greek speaker, so he writes very well in Greek. He was a companion of Paul at various times, from his second missionary journey to Paul's final imprisonment in Rome, and a loyal friend who remained with the apostle after others had deserted him, which we read about in 2 Timothy 4, verse 11. Because Paul went largely to the Greek world, or Gentile world, you'll see Greek and Gentile used interchangeably in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, but they just mean Gentile. They're commonly called, referred to as Greeks, but it's just referring to Gentiles, non-Jews, non-Israelites. Because Paul went largely to the Gentile world, that is what Luke's Gospel seems oriented to. His Gospel is historical and detailed because he is trying to establish in the Greek world the history of Jesus Christ. He writes to logically explain Jesus Christ because the Greek mind is supposed to be logical. The Greeks really prided themselves on their approach, their logical approach to life. And I write here that it's supposed to be logical because at the same time they're logical, but they worship the gods and goddesses of this and that. They believed in a primitive form of evolution and all this kind of stuff. So they pride themselves on their logic when their very thinking and religious practices are extremely illogical with the number of gods and goddesses and weird practices and so on that they had. Luke also includes a lot of detail in his gospel in the book of Acts that has been verified by archaeology, such as individuals who held office in particular cities at a particular time. This is rather interesting. One of the individuals, just saw this at the feast in Greece this year. There's an individual mentioned in the city of Corinth called Erastus, who's the city treasurer and becomes a member of the church. And you can go to Corinth, and in a large plaza, public plaza, Julie will remember seeing this, you can see there inscribed on a big stone on the ground, Erastus, the name of the person who's mentioned there in the book of Acts. So Luke includes a lot of details of different individuals, officials, governors, people like that who have been verified by archaeology. So it's interesting that, as I write here, Luke included all this to prove his message then, and ironically, his inclusion of all these details has allowed historians and archaeologists to prove his message today also. So you can see the living proof of the accuracy of what Luke wrote as verified through archaeology today. Recipient and purpose. The gospel is specifically directed to Theophilus, most excellent Theophilus as he's called, an individual whose name means, break it down, Theo, God, Philos. Philia is one of the types of love in the Greek language. So lover of God is what that name means. One who loves God or lover of God. The use of the title most excellent indicates that this was an individual and supports the idea that Theophilus may have been a Roman official or at least someone of high position and wealth. He was possibly Luke's patron, responsible for seeing that the writings were copied and distributed. Such a dedication to the publisher was common at that time. The fact that the gospel was initially directed to Theophilus does not narrow or limit its purpose. It was written to strengthen the faith of all believers and to answer the attacks of unbelievers. So, in other words, what this is saying is, you've probably heard of something like a book advance. For instance, Hillary Clinton just recently published a book about her view of the presidential campaign, and that she got a million dollar advance from the publisher. What publishers will do is advance several hundred thousand dollars to several million dollars to an author to support them while the author writes this book over the course of 6 months or a year or two. And that's essentially the type of system that is being described here, that Theophilus, this wealthy person who has apparently become a church member, is supporting Luke, paying for him, feeding him, clothing him, giving him a place to live while he writes the Gospel of Luke and then the book of Acts. So he's his patron, in other words. He is supporting Luke while he writes these two books for us. And because of that, we have them preserved for us today. We'll talk about the timing of that in a little bit and why how that all fits together. Continuing at the bottom of page 3 here, Luke was not an eyewitness. He spoke to those who were eyewitnesses. So this is a secondhand account. He spent a lot of time with the Apostle Paul, so obviously Paul was one of those sources. Luke begins his gospel with Luke 1 and verse 1, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us." So he tells us what he has done, his methodology, that he has interviewed eyewitnesses of these events, and and those who delivered the accounts of these events to us. And then he spells out the purpose in verses 3 and 4. "It seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." So Luke tells us several things here. He tells us that others have already written down accounts of Christ's life. It's possible he's referring to Matthew and Mark, but there are other accounts that were not preserved for us because God did not want or did not have them or did not see fit for them to be preserved. There are also false gospels that have been found that date to much later, that are not authentic. They are based on weird Gnostic beliefs and strange ideas and so on that actually contradict what the Bible really teaches. So they are definitely not inspired and not true. So some people say, well, Luke is referring to these Gnostic writings. No, he's not. Those are nonsensical, were written 100 or more years later and are just filled with all kinds of wacky stuff. So Luke then says that he determined to write an orderly account based on what he knew of these events. Well, how did he know about them? Well, again, he interviewed the eyewitnesses. For example, he includes a lot of details about Mary and the angel that appeared to Mary and to Joseph. How would Luke know these details? Well, he obviously learned about them from talking with Mary or other members of Jesus' family, as we talked about yesterday. Two of Jesus' brothers later become apostles in the church, James and Jude. So he probably interviewed them and got some of the information as well. He obviously talked to the other apostles who had been with Jesus during his ministry, and he was also a companion of Paul. And Paul may have shared with Luke things that Jesus had told him. Paul was personally taught by Jesus during 3 years in the desert when he is first called after he's miraculously struck down on the road to Damascus. Jesus takes him into the desert, teaches him personally, one-on-one, for 3 years. So some of this information may be what Luke has drawn from Paul and included in his gospel. Place of writing. The place of writing was probably Rome. By its detailed designation of places in the Holy Land, the gospel seems to be intended for readers who were unfamiliar with that land. So, in other words, he gives a fair amount of geographical detail there to people who are not familiar, not living in the Holy Land, as opposed to Matthew, where his audience is living in the Holy Land. Key points. Luke's gospel presents the works and teachings of Jesus that are especially important for understanding the way of salvation. He covers the entire story from the birth of Christ to his ascension to heaven, and in the book of Acts continues the story of the early church. His writing appeals to both Jews and Gentiles. It is characterized by literary excellence. Again, he's an excellent utilizer of the Greek language. Historical detail and warm, sensitive understanding of Jesus and those around him. Luke has a tender heart with a special emphasis on women, children, the family, and the poor, as we see from the stories and parables he includes that are excluded from other gospel writers. Being a Gentile, he recognizes the place of Gentiles as well as Jews and God's plan. Sources, again, Luke tells us that many others had written of Jesus' life, but Luke went beyond this for his own writing. He wrote based on testimony from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, including the preaching and oral accounts of the apostles. His blocks of distinctive material indicate independent work that doesn't appear in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, although he obviously used some of the same sources as Matthew and Mark. We'll talk about that a little bit more in our next hour. The plan of Luke. Luke basically covers Jesus' ministry geographically. How did Matthew organize his gospel? Around the five sets of sayings. How does Luke organize his gospel? He organizes it geographically, which we would never do if we were writing a biography for somebody. But again, this is 2,000 years ago, different culture, different way of thinking and approaching things. So, first covers the events that occurred in and around Galilee, then those events that took place in Judea and Perea. Perea is the area to the east side of the Jordan River. You can see that on your map. And then the final week in Jerusalem. The main theme of the gospel is the nature of Jesus' messiahship and mission. And a key verse is Luke 19 and verse 10. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Any questions about Luke? Yes, Julie. Yeah.
So then Luke, he interviewed and talked to all the eyewitnesses, and then it was Theophilus that Matthew wrote it down?
No, Luke wrote it down, but Theophilus was the patron, the one who supported him financially.
Oh.
It's not that he's paying for him, but paying his expenses, paying for his rent and food and so on. He's supporting Luke while he's doing the writing. But yeah, good question. But yeah, Luke is, yeah, just huge amount of detail. If you read any books, there's some excellent books on biblical archaeology, and they will repeatedly cite Luke in the book of Acts because Luke includes so much detail, names and places and titles of government officials in various places. All this detail has been verified by archaeology. We have an online reprint series. It's not in printed form, but it's an e-collection that we started doing in the Good News Magazine 20-something years ago called Archaeology in the Bible. And I'd recommend, if you're interested in that subject, dig that out for about 3 or 4 years. Mario Segli, who will be teaching some of your modules, actually I think he's teaching one on Archaeology in the Bible, wrote this series of about 15 or 20. So I would recommend... You look through again. Mario will probably cover some of that in one of his modules. I'm not sure when he's coming in.
I have a follow-up question.
Sure.
So
sure.
I'm getting a little confused about who's the author.
Well, Luke, part of the confusion. Luke wrote his gospel. He dedicated it, you might say, to Theophilus, the one who supported him. Let's just go to Acts 1 and verse 1, if you'll... flip over there. Yeah, here we go. And let me just read this to you. The former account, what's the former account? It's the Gospel of Luke. The former account I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began both to do and to teach until the day in which he was taken up, after he, through the Holy Spirit, had given commandments to the apostles whom he had chosen, to whom he also presented himself alive after his suffering by many infallible proofs, being seen by them during 40 days and speaking of the things pertaining to the kingdom of God. So again, he says, the former account I made, O Theophilus. So he's written this book of Acts to Theophilus, the person who has supported him during his time. And let me read the beginning of the Gospel of Luke here. Yeah, Luke 1:1. Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed. So both books are written to Theophilus. Luke doesn't explicitly state that Theophilus is the one supporting him during this, but this is a common literary formula from other documents of that time period where, for instance, Josephus, the Jewish historian that you'll hear mentioned a number of times while you're out here, Josephus was a Jewish writer, a Jewish author, and how to explain Josephus? He's a very complicated individual. He surrendered. He was a Jewish general during the Jewish revolt that broke out in 67 to 70 AD. He surrendered to the Romans and was supported then by the ruling emperor family, by Titus and... name escaped me of the next emperor who supported Josephus living in Rome while Josephus wrote his memoirs, which are thousands of pages, The Wars of the Jews, The Antiquities of the Jews, Against Apion and so on, wrote several major, major works, which you can find in the library here. So that was a fairly common thing in that day. You didn't have many authors who were famous enough in their own right to write and publish a book deal. So what you would do is have a wealthy patron who would support you and subsidize your living expenses while you wrote these works. So that is what is going on. Should have mentioned that. So I appreciate you bringing that up there, Julie. So, yeah, this is, the other authors aren't like this. They're all writing them just on their own. But Luke, being Gentile, being part of that Greco-Roman culture, is in a different circumstance here. So we'll talk about this a little bit more as we get into the next section. Let's see. All right, got just a couple of minutes here to cover John quickly. Let's see. Yeah, I'll hit John real quickly. The author of the Gospel of John is the Apostle John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. John, Hebrew, Yochanan, meaning God is a gracious giver. John is also the name of John Mark. So, as we mentioned yesterday, a lot of these names show up again and again because they're very common. He's the brother of another apostle, James, Jacob. Those two are the sons of Zebedee. John is also known as the apostle of love. You'll find that word often in John and also in the letters of John. James and John were at first called the sons of thunder. They are the ones who wanted to bring fire down out of heaven on a Samaritan village. And Christ said, "You do not know what spirit you are." But John changes through God's Spirit from a son of thunder who wants to burn up a Gentile city or town to the apostle of love. Shows the transforming power of God's Spirit on his nature. He became a good example of a man who is very deeply, deeply converted. He had a love of Christ, so much so that Jesus, when he was dying, looked at John and told him to take care of his own mother, Mary. Another factor that ties into this is John was a cousin of Jesus Christ, so Mary is actually John's aunt. We don't have time to go into the evidence for that, but you can read it in the booklet, Jesus Christ, the Real Story. And actually, that's on pages 58 and 59 is the family connections section. So would recommend you read that. John knew Jewish life well. We see this from references to popular messianic speculations, to the hostility between Jews and Samaritans, to Jewish customs, such as circumcision on the eighth day taking precedence over the prohibition of working on the Sabbath. John knew the geography of the Holy Land, including Bethany being about 2 miles from Jerusalem. He mentions Cana, a village not referred to in any earlier writing known to us. The Gospel of John has many touches that appear to reflect the recollections of an eyewitness, such as the house at Bethany being filled with the fragrance of the broken perfume jar when Mary, that should be Mary, sorry for the typo there, anointed Jesus before his death in John 12 and verse 3. Again, from an apologetic standpoint, a lot of people criticize the Gospels and say they couldn't have been written by eyewitnesses. All of this is made up. Well, why would you make up a detail like the room being filled with the smell of this very expensive ointment in there? Obviously, you don't make up a detail like that. It's just something that would never cross your mind. But John is an eyewitness, so he remembers writing decades after the fact how the whole room was filled with this lovely smell of this incense or ointment as Mary anoints Jesus before his death. The date, most people believe John's gospel was written much later, probably in the 90s AD, to supplement the accounts found in other gospels. Some also believe that the more developed theology of the fourth gospel and its counterarguments to Gnosticism indicates that it originated later. And I would certainly agree with those points. It's also thought that John wrote independently of the other Gospels and thus was likely written considerably later. Purposes and emphases. John's Gospel is rather different from the other three. The others are called the Synoptic Gospels. It's a term you need to repeat. Repeat after me, Synoptic. Synoptic. Okay, when we come across a new word for you, I'll sometimes ask you to repeat it so it embeds in your brain a little bit better there. Sin, break it down, S-Y-N, not S-I-N, two different kinds of sin. S-Y-N means with. Optic is talking about things like your optic nerve, seeing. So it means to see with one eye or the same perspective, the same viewpoint. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke give basically the same perspective, the same viewpoint. But John is very, very different, which we'll see later on. John is totally different here. John gives a view of Christ that is quite different from the others. He highlights matters that the other Gospels don't. There's very little overlap between him and what John covers, between what John covers and what we find in the Synoptic Gospels. The literary style is also unique among the Gospels. The Gospel of John has no parables, for instance. His focus is on the signs of Jesus' identity and mission and on deep, detailed theological discussions. His main purpose in John 20, verse 31, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John is also combating Gnosticism, covered that briefly yesterday, so this again is a primary reason why most scholars date John's gospel to late in the first century. Last paragraph, John talks a lot about Jesus' humanity, shows he was a human being who got tired, and John was an eyewitness to this. He says Jesus got thirsty, was troubled, but he truly loved people. All these very human characteristics that John emphasizes, they're diametrically opposed to what Gnosticism taught. So, okay, you can take your break now. We'll talk next about the dating, how we got the Gospels, more of the background.